Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
Big color, bigger savings. Sherwin-Williams Super Sale is here. Get 40% off paints and stains June 5th through the 11th with prices starting at $30.89. Whether you're refreshing your interior or exterior, we've got the colors to bring your vision to life. And with delivery, getting everything to your door is easier than ever. Shop online to have it delivered or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details. Delivery available on qualifying orders.
Hey, I'm Steph, and this is Not Today. Hello, and welcome. Before we jump into this week's case, I wanted to let you know that bonus episode number 52 is out now. Alex and I are discussing the Tromp family mystery, that is spelled T-R-O-M-P. In August of 2016, the Tromp family mysteriously fled their successful berry farm in Sylvan, Australia, on a spontaneous, off-grid road trip, without phones, credit cards, or passports. Over a 6-day period, they split up and were eventually found scattered across multiple states in paranoid, catatonic, or agitated states. It is one of the most famous cases of folie à deux, which means madness of two. And in this case, it's madness of many, which there is a French word for, but I never took French, so I'm going to stick to folie à deux. There are also other theories about what happened to the family, and we discuss them all. It's definitely a strange case, so if you want to get access to that episode and all the others, and vote on stories you want to hear, head over to patreon.com/nottodaypodcast. But today, we're going to be getting into a terrifying case about a 13-year-old boy who was kept in a box in the woods for 8 days and was subjected to unimaginable horror, his bravery through it all and in the years following. This case contains graphic details that may be distressing to some. Listener discretion is advised. In 1972, when Paul Martin Andrews moved with his family to Portsmouth, Virginia, from the much smaller rural town of Leesburg, Virginia, he and his siblings were really excited. Portsmouth is located in southeastern Virginia across the Elizabeth River from Norfolk. It's a historic waterfront city with just under 100,000 people. The city features maritime history, quaint architecture, and waterfront dining. Not only is it a beautiful city, but the Children's Museum there is considered one of the best museums in the state. Martin and his family were coming from a rural area, so Portsmouth was a much more exciting place to be. There was a ton more to do. Paul Martin Andrews, who goes by Martin, was born in 1959 in Leesburg, Virginia, to his parents, Anne and Jim. Martin was the oldest of their 3 children. He had a younger sister, Jenny, and a brother, Michael. Jim and Anne worked full-time, and since they were constantly at work, that left the kids responsible for themselves for the majority of the day. They were definitely latchkey kids. And since Martin was the oldest, he was pretty much in charge of his siblings. They were expected to get themselves up and ready for school in the morning, they had to get themselves to school, and when they got home, they would make themselves a snack and wait there until their parents got home from work. But when Martin was 12 years old, his parents decided to divorce. At first, this was difficult for the children, as it is for so many. However, in the end, it all worked out for the best, because years later, Jim came out as gay and went on to live with his partner for 45 years prior to his death. But at the time of the divorce, it was a really difficult transition for everyone. Martin's mother, Anne, ended up remarrying a year after the divorce, and that was when they moved over 200 miles south from Leesburg to Portsmouth. The kids were really looking forward to this move. It was a much-needed fresh start for the family, and it was especially exciting because now they would have much more to do aside from just hang out at home. They'd also get to live with their step-siblings, which was really great for them as well. They were all really close, and it brought their family from 3 kids to 6. At the time, Martin was 13 years old, and he was really enjoying his new home. He had made a bunch of new friends really easily, and even ended up getting a job as a paperboy, which he really enjoyed. The job gave him a little freedom from the chaos of his house, and he made a little bit of spending money for himself. But as good as things were shaping up to be for Martin and his family, Martin's life was about to take a very drastic and unexpected turn for the worse. January 10th, 1973 was a very cold day, but the kids got the incredible news that they didn't have to go to school because it was a snow day. Which is the best possible thing that can happen to a kid. I remember waking up on a school day knowing it had snowed the night before and rushing downstairs to the Weather Channel to see if the school had been closed and waiting for that call that was pre-recorded from the whoever it was, the principal, I don't even know, but it was just the best feeling in the world. And they got that news. So after Martin's paper route that morning, he planned on coming home, pulling his sled out, and having a really great afternoon with his siblings. He sprung out of bed that morning, bundled himself up, and set out to do his paper run for the day. And when he came home, since he was the oldest, it was his job to make sure his younger siblings had breakfast. But as Martin had begun making breakfast for his siblings, he realized they had run out of milk and a few other staples. The milk was something they could have gone without for the day, but Martin and his sister really wanted to make snow ice cream that afternoon, so he decided he would make the very quick trip to the store around the corner and grab them some. And I've never had snow ice cream, but that sounds incredible. I've had snow cones, where you just add a little flavoring to the top, but snow ice cream sounds like it's on a whole other level. And it's a very wholesome afternoon for Martin and his siblings. At least that's what it should have been. The convenience store was only a few blocks away, so round trip, this side quest, really should have only taken Martin a few minutes at most. But after Martin left his home that morning, he wouldn't see his family again for 8 days.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
Martin was no more than a block away from his home when all of a sudden a large blue van pulled up beside him with a man inside who had a very big smile on his face. Before Martin even realized what was going on, the man rolled down the window and said, "I'm in trouble. I need help. I have to move some furniture for my brother and I can't do it by myself. Could you help me? I'll give you a few dollars." Martin said every kid is warned about strangers and not getting into a car with a stranger, but he grew up in the country, where anyone in the neighborhood was considered your friend. So in that moment, Martin saw this man asking for help and wanted to be a good neighbor and a good kid, which he was. It didn't matter that Martin was only 13 years old, and no adult should ever be asking a child for help with something. He didn't feel as young as he was, and when you're a kid, you feel invincible. So it took very little convincing for this man to get Martin into his van. And at first, Martin felt totally fine about the whole interaction. Nothing seemed nefarious at first. But then the man pulled onto the highway, and that was when Martin started to get a little bit nervous. He didn't know how far away this supposed job was, and he began getting worried about how long this whole thing was going to take. Sure, he didn't mind helping out a neighbor, but he had to make his siblings breakfast and get to making some snow ice cream. He initially felt fine about helping this man out when he thought he was just going down the street, but suddenly things had gotten a little more intense, and Martin started to realize he really didn't know who this man was or where he was taking him. But it was almost as if this man felt the shift in Martin's energy, because right when Martin began getting nervous, the man suddenly reassured him, saying something along the lines of, "Don't worry, we don't have to drive far, and they weren't going to be long," which did make Martin feel a little bit better. And that was when the man formally introduced himself and started really chatting Martin up. He told Martin his name was Pee-wee and began asking him what he liked to do in his free time, what sports did he play, where did he go to hang out with his friends? Which seems like an innocent enough question, but knowing who this man is, that is a very creepy question to ask. But since Martin was a kind kid and had good manners, he participated in this conversation and answered all of the questions. The conversation went on for quite a while because this man had driven Martin nearly 30 miles away at this point. When they finally arrived at their destination, the man had driven Martin 25 miles southeast to Suffolk, Virginia. And Martin immediately got a sinking feeling once again. Not necessarily just because of the distance, but because the man initially told Martin he needed help moving furniture for his brother. So Martin had expected to arrive at someone's house. But where Pee-wee had brought Martin was the opening to a little deserted trail out in the middle of the snow-covered woods. The man told Martin they had to take some supplies to his brother's deer box, which is an enclosed structure used by hunters to stay concealed, warm, and protected from the weather while waiting for wildlife. This was a very different task than moving a few pieces of furniture, but now he was here, 25 miles from home in the middle of nowhere with a man he knew nothing about. Martin watched the man as he went to the back of the van and started rustling around with something, which was when he pulled out a large butcher knife and then put it in the waistband of his pants and closed his jacket around it. As soon as Martin saw that, everything in him was telling him to run. But despite every alarm bell in his body going off, he didn't. He didn't know what to do, where he was, what was going on, or where he would even go if he did run. He was in the middle of the woods in a completely different town, and he'd only been living in that general area for around 6 months at that point. He was terrified, but he felt like the only thing he could do was follow this man and hope that he was wrong. Maybe this was all one really weird misunderstanding. Martin followed this man down the path until they came to a clearing, where the man pointed to this large mound of dirt, and he said, "His deer box is just over there." When they walked over to it, there was a piece of metal with a handle. He grabbed it and lifted it up to show there was a box hidden in the ground. This box was an 8x4x4 shipping crate that had been buried in the ground. It was not big at all. Just from the opening, Martin could see some sleeping bags, blue plastic sheeting that was covering the floor, lanterns, and other supplies. Pee-wee then jumped into the opening and told Martin to do the same, so Martin apprehensively lowered himself into the box. They began straightening some things up in the box and moving a few things around, until suddenly the man stopped. That was when he pulled the knife on Martin and said, quote, "I've got bad news for you. You have just been kidnapped." And Martin's blood immediately ran cold. He was struck with a wave of fear and adrenaline. He described it almost like the feeling of being caught in a lie. He started to sweat and was consumed with the instinct to run and get out of there. In complete desperation, Martin told the man he knew karate in an attempt to make him feel scared, but that didn't work. The man jumped at Martin, who began thrashing and trying to fight him to get out of there, but the man managed to grab him before he could get out. Martin was doing everything he could to grab the knife out of the man's hands and wrestled him as best as he could to gain control, but that was when he suddenly punched Martin in the face. And stunned by the blow, Martin stopped fighting. He had Martin pinned and had total control at that point. He bound Martin's hands and feet and attached a chain around his ankle to make sure Martin wouldn't be able to escape. Almost immediately, the man had Martin strip out of his clothes and told Martin, quote, "What's going to happen, you're not gonna like." Martin would be assaulted repeatedly over the duration of his time in the box, always at knife point and with the threat of death if he didn't comply. And this was when the nightmare really began for Martin. That knife would be the one thing that really haunted him, because that was what the man used to intimidate Martin the entire time, and it's what kept him from running. The man was named Richard Alvin Osley. He was a serial child molester and pedophile. When Martin was being abducted, Richard Osley was actually on the run for kidnapping and raping another young boy, and he was due in court that day. Osley's criminal history went back to at least 1961. He did a very similar thing to what he had done with Martin, telling a young boy that he needed help fixing his car to lure him in and ultimately attack him. Even though Osley had done this at least two other times, he had been released on bail, which was why he was free and able to abduct Martin. Osley at the time had been living with his father, whose home was only a few streets over from Martin's family home. And for days, Martin was kept in this box, unable to step outside, stretch his legs, or even see the light of day. The day Martin was abducted, his younger sister had become very worried when Martin didn't return home after a few minutes of being out, because going to get milk really was not a time-consuming task. And when their parents returned home from work that day and learned Martin had never come home, they immediately panicked and went to police to report him missing. However, police initially didn't take Martin's disappearance seriously at all, which happened pretty frequently back then, and even still happens today. They had tried to convince Martin's mother that Martin hadn't been kidnapped, he was likely just a runaway, which is a tale as old as time. They told her as long as she sat tight and was patient, eventually Martin would just come back on his own. But Anne 100% disagreed. She knew her son and tried to explain to police that Martin was not the type of kid that would just run away. He hadn't taken anything with him. He had plans to spend a lovely afternoon with his siblings. It didn't make sense. But that didn't matter. The police weren't going to do anything at that point. They basically just sent Martin's parents away. There was no search, no investigation, nothing was done for the Andrews family. I don't even think a formal report was made on his disappearance. And meanwhile, Martin was living through a real nightmare. He was chained up in a box underground in the middle of nowhere in the dead of winter. As time went on, he began to notice that Osley's demeanor had changed. He would go from talkative and friendly to being withdrawn and very quiet, almost as if he were gearing up mentally to prepare himself for what he was about to do. But it was different than the other attacks. It seemed like Osley was preparing to kill Martin. Martin took note of his change, and when he'd see Osley's behavior begin to shift, he would start desperately trying to talk to him and distract him, that way he wouldn't withdraw, in hopes that whatever weird moment was happening would pass, and maybe whatever he was going to do wouldn't happen. Martin said, quote, "He was working himself up to kill me, and I don't think he could. He never saw the end game. I don't think he planned for it. And now he's stuck. He's stuck with this boy. It's going to cost him even more years in prison." The fact that Martin was this perceptive at 13 years old is honestly astounding. He had more emotional intelligence than Richard Osley did, and he was adjusting his behavior to try to keep Osley at bay, who was a grown man, by the way. Not that that matters at all, because this man is barely a human, he's a monster. But it just goes to show how smart Martin was, even at 13.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
During the day, Martin would be kept in the box with Osley, which was when things were really bad. But at night, Osley began allowing Martin out of the box with him, and they would cook dinner. And outside the box, Osley was like a completely different person. Martin was on his very best behavior and talked about anything and everything he could. There was nothing he wouldn't try to keep Osley at bay. He was only 13 years old, but he had this deep instinct to try to humanize himself to stay alive. He didn't know the right thing to do when you're in that situation, but it was deep within him. He had these instincts, which was just amazing, and ultimately probably did keep him alive. But by the third day, Osley began talking with Martin about what would need to be done to facilitate getting him back home to his family, specifically how he could get Martin home safely without Osley seeing any consequences for what he had done. And together, the two started talking through the different scenarios. And there were two that Osley really considered. One was for Martin to go home and claim that he'd run away, and the other was Osley would leave Martin in the box by himself, and he would get a head start running away before he called his mother, meaning Martin's mother, to let her know where she could find her son. But regardless of the scenarios they discussed, Osley could not take blame for what he had done. He'd either be completely out of the picture, or he would get away. And as far as Martin was concerned, he didn't care how it happened. He just wanted to get out of there. He would say or do anything he had to get back home to his family. So he asked Osley to just leave him in the box and asked him to send his mother to him. But Osley didn't like that answer. I think he wanted Martin to say that he would lie and say that he had just run away. Because when Martin suggested Osley leaving him in the box and calling his mother, Osley restrained Martin, got on top of him, and beat him mercilessly as he screamed at Martin. He became suddenly enraged. He told Martin since he couldn't lie, he was a goody-two-shoes, and now he was going to have to keep him there. Osley even cried during this outburst. And fearing for his life, Martin began consoling his captor. Martin then began apologizing to Osley and tried to say anything he could to get Osley to calm down. But after that beating, Martin had two black eyes, a cracked tooth, his nose was broken, and he was in unbelievable amounts of pain. And yet he's trying to console Osley. Because what other choice did he have? He said this was by far the closest he came to actually dying in the box. This outburst was really, really bad. But Martin did exactly what he needed to in order to survive, because whatever he said must have somewhat worked, because that night, it seemed like Osley trusted Martin even more. From that beating on, he began taking Martin out of the box even more, little by little. They would go on short walks, or he would let him sit outside the box around the campfire without being confined. And that led to another realization for 13-year-old Martin. As long as they were out of the box, nothing terrible would happen. And as I said earlier, Martin began realizing that outside the box, Osley was a completely different person. He was even almost pleasant outside the box. And as a way to survive, Martin was able to compartmentalize the horrors that he was experiencing inside the box. And anytime he was out of the box, he and Osley would just hang out, almost as if they were friends who were just camping together in the woods. Martin said it almost felt like he was camping with an uncle or his dad. He said, quote, he was very nice. He was interesting to talk to. He had a lot of knowledge about carpentry and the woods, which were things that Martin was interested in. And he almost enjoyed that time. And this is from the point of view of a 13-year-old who was deeply traumatized at this point and had to do what he had to do to survive. His brain was protecting him. He, of course, did not enjoy hanging out with Richard Osley, but he enjoyed being out of the box. He realized Osley wouldn't attack him while they were outside, so it became extremely important to him to keep him outside. But even with these few good moments, he knew that his time was running out. And at night, as he lay in the box, he thought about what his mother must be going through. He thought about his family all the time, and the idea of his mother worrying at home and crying about him, and potentially never knowing what happened to him, bothered him more than anything else. And for 8 whole days, Martin lived this nightmare, until finally, on January 18th, Osley told Martin, after that day, he wasn't going to hurt him anymore. He was going to leave him in the box and eventually send his mother to come and find him. And this was the first real glimmer of hope that Martin had in 8 days. He finally felt like this nightmare was going to come to an end, and he would get to go home and see his family, which was all he wanted. But before Osley left, he attacked Martin one final time before gathering his things and leaving Martin alone in the box. And finally, he was alone, freezing, terrified, and chained in this box underground, clinging to the hope that Osley would actually send his mother. And at this point, Martin did believe that he would. He had to cling on to that hope. It was all he had. But unsurprisingly, this evil man had no intention of sending anyone for Martin. All he planned to do was leave him there, chained up and unable to escape, while he fled and avoided all possible consequences for his monstrous actions. But Martin didn't know that. And that night, he finally got his first decent sleep because he felt much safer alone in that box underground than he did with Osley there with him. That just goes to show how deep and terrifying this nightmare truly must have been, because Martin felt safe underground in a small box, which he was chained to in the middle of the woods in the dead of winter. And he got his first real sleep, which shatters my heart into pieces thinking about it. January 19th, 1973 was the 8th day of Martin's captivity. And when he woke up, he was still there, alone in the box. And he became frantic. He needed to get out of there. So he began pulling the chain, hoping by some miracle he could get it to release from the side of the box. But no matter how hard he pulled, he wasn't going anywhere. He became so desperate to break it that at one point he tried cutting through it with fingernail clippers that he had found in Osley's abandoned belongings. The nail clippers had made small dents, and maybe he would have been able to get through it eventually, but I think more realistically, he probably wouldn't have been able to cut through the chains with only a pair of small nail clippers. So Martin did the only thing left he could think of to do, and that was pray. He prayed for hours, and promised God that if he let Martin live, he would do better, and he'd be better. Which again just shatters my heart, thinking about this kid sitting in the box by himself, promising God that he would be a better kid, when he was already a good kid. Nothing he had done had put him in this box. He was in the wrong place at the wrong time, but I'm sure we all know that. The next morning around 8 a.m., as Martin sat there, unsure if he'd ever see his family again, he heard the unmistakable sound of an engine and tires driving on the snow above him. Since he was in the middle of nowhere, Martin assumed this must be his mother and father who were finally coming to get him out there, because seeing anyone else out there seemed impossible. It had been 8 days, and he hadn't heard anything like this up until that point. So using all of the length of chain that he had, with his leg completely outstretched behind him, Martin had just enough room to stick his head out of the lip of the box. Just enough to the point where he could see whoever was coming. And he very quickly realized that this wasn't his parents at all. The driving he had heard on the snow was actually 2 pickup trucks that were being driven by a group of men who were out rabbit hunting. And the sight of these 4 men wasn't immediately exciting for him because everything in him believed that this was going to be his mother. And when it wasn't, he was so disheartened. He began screaming and yelling, "Please stop," along with a bunch of cuss words at them because he was so upset. Recalling this moment, Martin said, quote, "I'm always reminded of this when I watch The Silence of the Lambs and the girl in the pit screams profanities at Jodie Foster as she's being rescued." But regardless of what Martin was screaming, the men did thankfully hear him, and after a few moments of them looking around very confused, they finally spotted him in the ground. He was just a small head peeking up from the snow. They found this poor, beaten child chained up in a box underground, and he told them, "I've been kidnapped." For one of the hunters, the sight of Martin was just too much, and he needed to step away, but they very quickly called the police. What was so unbelievable about this chance encounter was these men weren't even supposed to be hunting in that area that day. This group of hunters was a part of a bigger group that went hunting in a completely different area. But for whatever reason, these men had made the very last-minute decision to break off from the larger group and go hunting in that area. If they had not chosen to do that, there is a very good chance Martin may have never been found, at least while he was alive. But possibly even at all. Nobody knew where he was and no one was coming for him. Not only is it incredible that these hunters came to this area at all, but it's also incredible that they came when they did. It was only 1 night after Martin had been left alone in the box. If it had been even days later, Martin may not have survived, one, but two, he would have been sitting there, slowly losing hope that his parents were coming to get him and realizing that Osley had lied. It is a really awful thought, but thankfully that did not happen. When police finally arrived on the scene, they photographed Martin in the box as he had been left before they unchained him. Finally, the chain was cut, and Martin was pulled out of the box and immediately transported to the hospital to have his wounds treated. On the way to the hospital, Martin asked where they were taking him, and when he found out what hospital he was being transported to, he told them they needed to take him to the hospital where his mother worked, which they did. And it was in the exam room that Martin heard his mother's voice and footsteps running down the hall for the first time. When his mother finally made it through the police and doctors in that room, Martin practically flew off of the exam table and into his mother's arms. He said that reunion is one of the clearest memories he has from the whole experience. Police have since said that as soon as they began their investigation, they had a hunch as to who was responsible for Martin's abduction, which honestly makes me extremely angry, because they didn't do anything when Martin was reported missing by his parents on the very first day. It took them 8 days after Martin was already found to be like, a missing kid, and there's a sexual predator in the area. I think I have an idea as to who this could have been. But just the kid being missing alone wasn't enough to trigger the police doing an investigation? It's absolutely ludicrous. Osley was a known predator and lived only streets over from Martin, so it didn't take a genius to figure out who was behind it. The day Osley had abducted Martin, he was due to be in court for the abduction and assault of a different boy, which he obviously never showed for. So that should have been a red flag to begin with, even before Martin's parents reported him missing. But now that Martin was found and the police had the light bulb epiphany that Richard Osley was behind all of this, they began an investigation.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
They presented Martin with a photo lineup while he was still in the hospital, and within a split second, Martin pointed out Richard Alvin Osley, which he said he knew as Pee-wee. Richard Osley was arrested and taken into custody and charged for what he had done to Martin, only 4 days after Martin's rescue. Meanwhile, Martin was trying his very best to get back to normal. He reunited with his siblings and his friends, but things were far from easy. And once everything had died down following Martin's return home, the police told Martin's parents that because of what he had been through, he could actually become a threat to other kids' safety. They even went so far to insinuate he might begin to act out sexually because of what had been done to him. And that makes me so angry, because Martin started to feel like he was almost in trouble for what he had survived. They were making him feel like he was doing something wrong, which he was not. The cycle of abuse is a very real thing, but Martin had never given anyone any reason to believe that he was a threat, and now they were treating him as if he were the monster. And because the story of what happened to Martin is so shocking, a professional psychiatrist even called Martin a liar and told his parents that Martin should be institutionalized because he didn't believe Martin's story. I would love to line up the investigators and this psychologist and slap them all across the face. Very hard. Yay, they got Richard Osley after 4 days, but that is the only thing they did for Martin. It wasn't a small thing, but he needed support, and they were treating him terribly. This extremely bright psychiatrist also told Martin's parents that he shouldn't talk about his experience. Martin said, quote, "My parents were told if I wasn't allowed to speak about it, that I would forget about it, that it would just go away." And what happened over time, though, was that everyone forgot about it. Everyone except me. Martin was sent to a psychiatric ward. And while this was a brief stint and he didn't really feel like he needed to be there, he did participate in some individual therapy, which hopefully helped him a little bit. It really sucks that Martin had to continue being brave and strong after living through this unimaginable horror. But unfortunately for him, the professionals around him and his family and the people in his life were not supporting him in the way that he needed, and he was alone in this. Osley's trial began on September 27, 1973, and again, Martin was incredibly brave and took the stand and confidently gave his testimony, and never once broke down. He said at that point he wasn't even scared of Richard Osley, who wasn't even looking at him. Osley's defense was that he hadn't kidnapped Martin, but that Martin had gone with him willingly, and at no point was he ever held prisoner. He claimed everything that happened was consensual, and Martin was free to leave and come back whenever he wanted to. As if police hadn't found this child chained up in an underground box in the middle of nowhere. It was a ridiculous argument. But at the time, Richard Osley was an incredible manipulator, and his team did such a good job that the prosecution was actually worried. It was shocking how well they had been able to spin the story and use the things that he had learned about Martin to try to play off what actually had occurred. Which was ridiculous. In no world is anything that happened consensual. And thankfully, the jury wasn't buying the defense's bullshit. They went on to find Richard Osley guilty of 2 counts of sodomy, as well as his kidnapping charges. And with all of that combined, he was sentenced to 48 years in prison. By the time Osley was convicted in Martin's case and was serving time in prison, Martin discovered that he actually wasn't alone in this, and that Osley had been convicted in at least two other sexual assault charges. And when the judge gave Osley his sentence, the prosecutor looked at Martin and promised him that in all likelihood, he would never have to deal with Richard Osley ever again. But sadly, that wouldn't be true. Following the trial, Martin and his family tried to get back to how it was before. His parents still discouraged Martin from talking about it, so Martin never did. He pushed down what happened to him and fell into a deep depression. He felt like he had this massive secret that he had to keep to himself for the sake of everyone else. To the point where Martin got married and his spouse never knew what he had gone through. Friends he had for years never knew about this part of his life. Meanwhile, Martin was having panic attacks in the grocery store because he saw the same brand of knife that Richard Osley used to threaten him. Martin ended up moving to Florida, hoping to get away from anyone who had known about his past, since seeing anyone look at him any sort of weird way was a painful reminder. But it was all an internal struggle for him, because on the outside, Martin presented himself as totally fine. But in reality, he was being torn apart. And the doctors in Florida weren't any more help than the ones he saw back in Virginia. He said, quote, "They didn't really know what to do with a child who had gone through what I had gone through and survived. So I self-medicated. I was going down." All this silence did was push Martin further and further away from his family, and he desperately tried to reinvent himself. He thought as long as he could keep up appearances, maybe one day he too would be able to just forget about everything he had been through, just like everyone else in his life had been able to do. He lived like that for 30 years. By 2002, Martin had done everything he could to build a good life for himself. He became a successful computer programmer, he had married his partner Mark, he had friends, he went out and did things and put on a happy face. No one would have guessed Martin was hiding this massive trauma that he had experienced as a child. That was until one phone call brought everything Martin had been keeping a secret deep inside him right back up to the surface. In June of 2002, Martin received the news that Richard Osley was up for parole, and Martin was horrified. He believed that Richard Osley would be spending the rest of his life behind bars, and now suddenly he had the chance to get out. And Martin knew he couldn't let that happen. But that meant facing what he had been through all over again, and it also meant Martin's secret would come out. But that didn't matter. He knew that if Richard Osley got out of prison, he would strike again, and that victim may not be as lucky as Martin had been. So for the first time since his childhood, Martin publicly acknowledged his story and made a plea for Richard Osley's continued incarceration. Despite having passed the Civil Commitment of Sexually Violent Predators Act around 1999, Virginia had never allocated any funding to maintaining or even starting this program. This program was supposed to allow the state to commit sexually violent predators to a psychiatric facility after the completion of their criminal prison sentence. These laws were designated to incapacitate individuals deemed highly likely to reoffend due to a diagnosed mental abnormality or personality disorder. There was a chance they would be let out if they could be deemed with certainty that their chances of reoffending were gone, but there was also a really good chance that they would never get out. In the program, they would receive intensive psychotherapy, and from that, the providers could determine a risk level for reoffense. But since the state had never funded this program, Richard Osley was about to be set free once again. And Martin couldn't let that happen. So he reached out to anyone he could think of that might be able to do something about this program and keeping Osley from being released. Critics of this law said it was double jeopardy, keeping someone confined in a mental institution even after their prison sentence had been satisfied. But Martin pointed to the results. He said, quote, "The ones that have graduated from the program have a recidivism rate of about 4%, whereas going in, it's at about 75%. They have to work the program, because if you don't work the program, you don't get better. And if you don't get better, you don't get out." Martin contacted the parole board, governors, senators, lieutenant governors, the attorney general. He even sat down with the FBI's behavioral analyst unit and gave a presentation to them. He really did every single thing he could. He left no stone unturned. He needed to get it out there that the state had dropped the ball on this extremely important program. And because of that, this serial offender would be set free once again. And not just Richard Ausley, but countless others. He went from hiding this huge event in his life from everyone to stepping out and screaming about it from the rooftops for the sake of protecting other children and doing the right thing. And thankfully, after all the work he did, the media picked up Martin's story and his fight for justice, and they ran with it. Because of the media coverage, very influential people in Virginia's political scene were stepping up and speaking out in support for Martin, which was huge. He was really getting somewhere. In fact, the only person who outwardly opposed the work Martin was doing was Richard Ausley. Which makes sense to me. I don't think anyone would outwardly disagree with Martin about the fact that sexual predators should be put away for longer. But Ausley went as far as contacting the media himself and requested he be allowed to tell, quote-unquote, his side of the story. He sat down with a reporter and began claiming that he was the real victim in all of this. He was furious in this interview, saying that Martin was unfairly targeting him for no reason at all, and he actually cried. One minute he was staring down the barrel of the camera crying and whining, and the next he was enraged and screaming about how this wasn't his fault. He said he never deserved to be in prison because everything that happened between him and Martin in the box was consensual. It seems like he had spent every day of his 30 years in prison convincing himself that he were actually the victim. He took absolutely no accountability and even tried to downplay it, saying, quote, "What I did, I did. He's not maimed or crippled, he's alive." Which again is just outrageous, and shows that even after all that time, he still had zero remorse and didn't see what he did as a problem, because Martin was still alive, so what's the big deal? After this interview, Virginia officials pushed the funding through on the program to keep Ausley locked up. His bright idea to plead his case to the media absolutely backfired on him. Which of course it did, it was never going to sound sane, what he was saying. But it was genuinely shocking to see just how unhinged Ausley really was. And in 2003, the program was signed by the governor and enacted. And since then, over 400 offenders have been civilly committed in Virginia. In the US, 20 states, the federal government, and the District of Columbia have a version of these commitment laws, which are referred to as sexually violent predator or sexually dangerous person laws. It's keeping dangerous predators off the streets, which is incredible. There's no way of knowing how many people and children this program has actually saved, but it's probably in the thousands. What Martin did to get this program up and running in Virginia is incredible and so brave. After a lifetime of hiding his pain, he stepped out of the shadows, and because of his determination, he's protected so many children from experiencing the horrors that he endured. Also because of Martin's work, another completely unknown Ausley victim came forward and told his story, and he went on to press charges against him as well. But Ausley would never actually have a chance to qualify for the civil commitment program, because in January of 2004, when he was 64 years old, Ausley was murdered by his cellmate, a young man who was a victim of sexual abuse himself. And when Martin was informed of his attacker's death, the day it happened, he said he took no pleasure in hearing about it, no satisfaction, or particular sense of justice. I, however, feel differently. He said, quote, "That's not what I wanted for Richard Ausley. Richard Ausley needed to serve his time. I didn't have a lot of hate for him. I think a lot of people were very upset that I didn't hate him. Hate can eat you alive. But I was able, after a period of time, to forgive him. I just don't want other children to go through that." And that's very big of Martin. I'm genuinely very happy that that is where he's at in his feelings about all of this, and that he isn't holding on to hatred for Richard Ausley, because, like he said, that can eat you alive. But he has every reason in the world to feel happy and vindicated for Richard Ausley being murdered by his cellmate. But I also understand Martin wanting Richard to serve out his sentence, because that doesn't seem very pleasant either. Martin said, quote, "I survived because God gave me peace to be able to keep my mind and my wits about me. If there's anything that I could say to children who are being abused or have been abused, to adults that have been abused as children, it's that you've done nothing wrong and you have nothing to be ashamed of. As long as you keep it to yourself, they get away with what they've done. They've not paid the price for what they've done to you. And you can take hope that there can be a life that you can live without fear, You can live without that pain. And he's an incredible example of that. Even after 30 years of hiding what he had been through, he faced it. And today, it seems like he's living an amazing life. What he went through will never go away, but at least now, he's been able to make peace with it and not feel like he's going through life alone. Over 50 years after his abduction, Martin Andrews remains an activist for civil commitment programs and regularly speaks to victims' advocates, law enforcement, and probation and parole personnel about his personal experiences, civil commitment laws, and working with victims and the media. He regularly speaks with victims' groups, delivering his message of survival, hope, and healing through grace and advocacy. So to make a long story short, Martin Andrews is an amazing person. He's done incredible work. He's unbelievably brave, and he continues helping other people. I'm so proud of him, and I'm very happy for him, and honestly, I'm in awe of all that he's accomplished and overcome. But that is Martin Andrews' story, and I think I want to leave it there. So why don't we move on to a bit of a palate cleanser, and I can tell you something good, that way we can go on with our days as normal. My good thing is hobby-related. It is that I have made a couple really good scrapbooking pages recently that I'm pretty proud of. And that I've realized that thrift stores around me have some scrapbooking material that I can use, and that's amazing. I'm in the market for some more good sticker books, because stickers really do tie the page together, I gotta be honest. Which is kind of a silly good thing, but hey, it's about the little things, right? That, and I had my first watermelon of the season, which is my favorite summer fruit. So yeah, that's my good thing. I wish a good melon upon all of you, and if you don't like melon, grow up. But I'm going to keep it light because this is the good things. So you're entitled to not like melon if you don't like melon, but I just find that to be a character flaw. So anyway, thank you all so much for listening. And if you would like to check out all the bonus episodes we have, head over to patreon.com/nottodaypodcast. Head over to my YouTube channel called Steph Today to find even more content. I have a new video in the works now and more coming in the future. We post pictures of all the stories we talk about over on Instagram at nottoday_podcast. If you or anyone you know is a story of survival or something crazy that's happened to you and you'd like to share with us and possibly hear it on an upcoming listeners episode, send it to notodaypodcast@gmail.com. We have a TikTok that is Not Today Podcast and a Twitter that is Not Today Podcast, but the T in the podcast is a 3 because that makes sense. And just keep breathing. Yeah.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit Dick's.com/scorecardplus for details.